Okay, we'll bring the public safety and crime prevention policy and community together, I should say, until we get a quorum. And what's that?
We have one.
Oh, we do have a quorum now. Yeah. Okay, well, let's start out with a roll call then.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean. Representative Hertos. Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Howe.
Here.
Representative Lohmer.
Here.
Representative Lucero. Representative Neuberger.
Raise,
Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Rosenthal.
Here.
Representative Schoen. Representative Ward. Representative Winkler. And Representative Zerwas.
Representative Considine is here to check in. Representative O'Neill, would you like to move the minutes for March 24th?
Yes, sir.
Representative O'Neill moves the minutes for March 24th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, members, we if we could today, we can come back at 7 o'clock tonight, but I'd rather whisk through the bills if we could. I hate to say that there's nothing controversial because I did that before and then one of them did turn up that way, but they should be. I think the DFL is in agreement if the GOP is, will try not to talk too much on the bills unless we've got something really need to say, and then we can get done and not have to come back tonight. It's, the first bill is Representative Ledinsky and it's House File 1884, and the chair would move House File 1884. It'd be recommended to pass and move to the general register. Representative Ledinsky, go ahead.
Aye, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee this morning. This House File 1884 is pretty straightforward because the law in Section 340A 5.503 is so very specific. In the area of what can or cannot be used as identification in the purchase of alcohol. We are simply adding a valid instructional permit that includes a photograph issued under section to an illegal, some are to an adult of legal age to purchase alcohol. That is simply because in the unique states that maybe someone didn't get a license while they were 16 or over the age of 21, those people that would have an instructional permit, technically under law, shouldn't, or we can't use that permit as a, and we're just simply opening up so they can purchase alcohol. So there you go. We have a testifier here that can add to quite a bit of the conversation. So,
okay, go ahead, ma'am. State your name and organization and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sarah Pasek. I represent the Minnesota Municipal Beverage Association and Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association, which are retail liquor stores in Minnesota. And this bill was just brought to us by a liquor store clerk who had noticed that the instructional permit is not a valid form of ID. And because, as Representative Swazinski said, Minnesota law is so prescriptive of what are valid forms of ID, we wanted to add that in so that they were following the letter of the law on acceptable forms of ID. So thank you for your support.
Okay, any questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is just once they actually get the photograph, learner's permit. It's not with a different ID and the piece of paper while they're waiting, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's correct.
Okay, members, any questions? If not, the chair, you need closing comments?
No.
If not, public testimony. Anybody of public testimony or in opposition? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion for House File 1884 to pass and move to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Representative Hillstrom, we had House File 840 up yesterday. And we were going to send it to another committee, but we found out it doesn't have a fiscal note. In fact, the companion bill had a fiscal note in the Senate, and it come back as zero. And so there's no need to send it there. So I'd like to move to reconsider, bring it up again, and amend the motion to send it to the general register, if that's okay. Representative Hilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's nothing else in the bill within the jurisdiction of that committee. It just, they were the ones that would have had to pay for it. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
That's my understanding, that there's nothing in their jurisdiction.
Then I have no objection, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the House, or the Chair, will move to bring reconsideration to House File 840 and bring it up. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Now, House File 840 is before us. The Chair would move House File 840 be recommended to pass.
Do I ask if it's been amended?
No.
Okay. Recommended to pass and move to the General Register. Questions, all in, Representative Howell.
Could you just tell us what it is?
Oh, yeah, that was the elections bill from Representative Sanders that went, we were going to send it to another committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Now our next bill would be Representative Smith and House File 1770.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I brought treats for your committee.
Could
I have
them out? Well, thank you, sir. Give you five left not questions on your.
No, you did a good job.
The Chair will move House File 1770 to recommend it to pass and move to the General Register. Do you have any testifiers today, Representative Smith?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Smith, go ahead and begin with your name and introduce your bill.
Thank you. Representative Dennis Smith. Mr. Chair, House File 1770 is a county government-friendly bill. It allows a conciliation court to have jurisdiction over claims owed to their own county. It's a friendly to the counties, to the county courts, both for metro and outstate. There's no opposition to this bill that I'm aware of.
Okay, members, and a no fiscal note, Representative. Any questions here? Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What currently happens? If they don't have control of themselves currently, who handles it?
Yep. Representative Smith.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Howell. Currently, the jurisdiction is based on where you live, but this would allow, so I'm a resident of Hennepin County. If I'm up in Duluth for the weekend and I receive a parking ticket and I choose not to pay that parking ticket, right now, the county attorney or representative of the county would need to come down to Hennepin County to file a conciliation court claim. And this would allow them to force me to go to conciliation court in their county to defend that particular issue.
Any other questions, members? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, I commend your bravery on doing this. The last time you brought treats to the committee, you sugared us up, and it took an hour. So I commend your bravery.
Today's a brand new day, Mr. Representative. Thank you.
Okay, any more questions for Representative Smith?
You got to make a motion with your hands so I can see you. Go ahead, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, I'm sorry, I just wasn't quite clear on what you were saying there. So if I get a parking ticket in St. Louis County, this allows them to come after me in Blue Earth County?
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, no, the opposite. If this allows the county to pursue the claim or the pursuit of that money that's owed to them within their own county, which is the most efficient mechanism for them to do that as opposed for them to transporting their valuable resources to the county that you reside in.
So they can take me to court up in St. Louis County and then just bill me. Is that the...
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, yes, sort of. So the yes is the short answer, but so the example of I live in Hennepin County and you represent which county?
Blue Earth.
So... I'm visiting you, and I receive a parking ticket. Blue Earth County could then pursue that non-payment in their own county conciliation court. Right now, the law reads they need to come down to Hennepin County, where I live, to pursue it, which is problematic for several reasons. So this allows the state government to be more efficient, pursue the claims owed to them within their own county, not have to travel throughout the state.
I think the bottom line here, Mr. Chair, is I have to be more careful with my parking.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative Smith in 1770? Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Smith. Just a quick question. So we'll use St. Louis County as an example. I live in Hennepin County. If they have a claim against me and they go to conciliation court and set a date and I go up there and I win, am I able to recover my costs in, you know, being driving up or flying up, which I probably wouldn't do, to St. Louis County, as well as any other type of legal expenses which I may have incurred in the process of defending myself?
Representative Smith? Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, no is the short answer. Just like the county, when they, in the current law, where they would need to come down to your county and defend themselves, they're not able to recoup that cost either. Conciliation court doesn't allow that type of recoverable claims. Other types of courts, it can, but this bill deals strictly with conciliation court, where those types of fees would not be recovered.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative Smith? Seeing none, public testimony. Anybody out there? Okay, Chair will renew his motion for House File 1770, recommended pass, and go to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, Representative Joachim, House File 805, the Silver Alert Bill. Welcome, Representative, and if you want to...
I too have red treats.
Oh, wow.
Now I hope these are apples.
No, this is the third stop the bill's made, but I am reading the new freshman rule as every new committee you go to, regardless, you're supposed to be bringing treats. So
okay.
I'm a stickler for the rules.
Representative, I'll move your bill for you. House File 805 be recommended to pass and go to the General Register, and I'll go ahead with your bill however you would like.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I know your agenda is full, so I'll keep it very brief. I appreciate the hearing. I also want to give special thanks to the bipartisan group of co-authors I have on this bill. On this committee, too, Representative O'Neill, Representative Schoen, and Representative Considine. As members, we always bring forward bills that are either born of experiences that we've had or things that people have talked to us about. And for me, that's this case with this bill. My grandmother, who's now gone, had Alzheimer's the last few years of her life. At the time, she was a widow living alone in her home, and her children were sharing the task of taking care of her. I know that's a very familiar story in homes across Minnesota and maybe among those around the table. My mom and her siblings were able to afford part-time care, and they divided up the rest of the caregiving, but there's always was that worry or concern that my grandmother would get out of the house on her own somehow. She lived in North St. Paul, just a block off of Lake Phalen, so the proximity of water was a big concern, as well as the Minnesota winters. If a vulnerable adult that has Alzheimer's, dementia, or traumatic brain injury does wander off, minutes could make a difference, and that is where the Silver Alert comes in. It would be patterned after the Amber Alert and be able to get information out quickly to notify law enforcement of a missing vulnerable adult. I first learned of the concept of Silver Alerts from a colleague and decided to make it one of my priorities this year. Through my experience with my grandmother and my grandfather, who also had dementia at the end of his life, I decided to sit down and figure out what resources Minnesota already had, and that led me to Janelle Rasmussen, who's here with the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. She's the Director of Criminal Justice Training and Education with the BCA, and she oversees the Amber Alert, and she's been part of crafting national criteria around that. I was concerned as well with the Amber Alert of not making sure that we're not overtaxing the system, that there were strong criteria. I didn't want to duplicate anything that we already had, so that led me to having this bill have a working group of stakeholders that could come together and figure out what processes we already have in place, where the holes are, what's missing, and then come back with recommendations in January of next year to the legislature to see what a program would look like, how much it might cost, what the criteria would be. So I have General Rasmussen here. I also have support from the Alzheimer's Association. There should be a letter in your packet. And I have Heidi Haley Franklin, and three committees, you think I'd get it right. Vice President for Clinical Services at the Alzheimer's Association to give brief testimony on the concerns of wandering, if you so choose.
Hey, ma'am, if you want to state your name and organization and begin. Thank you. Sure.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Heidi Haley Franklin. I'm the Vice President of Clinical Services with the Alzheimer's Association. And the Alzheimer's Association is the world's leading health organization in Alzheimer's care, support, and research. I'd like to express our strong support for House File 805 to create a working group to thoughtfully determine the need for a silver alert system in the state of Minnesota. Currently, there are an estimated 100,000 Minnesotans living with Alzheimer's disease and an additional 245,000 family caregivers who are providing care and support. With age being the greatest risk factor for Alzheimer's, this number is set to skyrocket. Alzheimer's is a public health crisis and the defining disease of the baby boomer generation. The reality is that 6 out of 10 individuals with Alzheimer's or dementia will wander at some point in the disease process, and many will wander repeatedly. Caregivers expect symptoms of severe memory loss and confusion, but they don't always, they're not always prepared to be on a state of alert to monitor the whereabouts of their family members with dementia. These family caregivers never know when wandering will take place. However, they know it can be dangerous and often life-threatening. If individuals with dementia are not found within 24 hours, up to 50% of those who wander will suffer serious injury or death. In addition, a person with memory loss may not be able to provide their name, address, phone number to somebody who finds them, and they may not appear to even know that they're lost. Even if they're located, reuniting them with a family member presents challenges. Wandering can be a common symptom of dementia and can pose a constant stress which weighs heavily on caregivers and all family members. These wandering incidents must be treated as an emergency, and the response must begin immediately. As you can imagine, it can only take a moment for someone to walk away, and it can be true of any setting, whether it's at home, the mall, or a grocery store. Most individuals who wander can be located within 1.5 miles from home, and living in greater Minnesota poses unique challenges as well. Wandering is not limited to community settings. It can take place in assisted living facilities, nursing home facilities, memory care facilities, which creates even greater urgency for immediate action to take place. I urge the committee to move forward this very important piece of legislation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is my understanding that DPS would probably testify that they're not in opposition, they're going to work with you and
yes, I would love to have Janelle Rasmussen drop down here real quick just maybe to address. I know there was just a request today for a fiscal note. Maybe she can address that as well.
Ma'am, if you'd like to give us a brief testimony as to their position of the department on this, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janelle Rasmussen. I am the Amber Alert Coordinator for the state of Minnesota at the BCA. We talked earlier this year about the Blue Alert and how Amber Alert works in Minnesota and the systems that we currently use for cases that would meet a so-called Silver Alert criteria here in Minnesota, and I'm happy to answer any questions on that. But this work group gives us an opportunity to work with all of the stakeholders to look at what we're currently doing in Minnesota and if there's any areas for improvement or changes. We know that in the United States there are over 20 states that have Silver Alert right now and 15 other states that have other systems in place that are similar or like the Silver Alert plan. Minnesota is one of those states. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have on any of that.
Okay, member questions. Representative Joachim, thank you very much for your bill, and to understand that it's a work group and they'll come back and recommendations as to progress for next year, hopefully.
And I just want to thank you guys so much. I know that this is not a unique story that I've shared with you. I think this legislation is a great first step to make sure the safety of our seniors, especially with such a large population of our seniors aging in place. And it's really been a true labor of love, and I hope you'll see its worth and moving on to the general registry.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Seeing no questions, the chair would renew the motion. House File 805 be passed and move. Oh, excuse me, public testimony? Anybody? The chair would renew the motion for House File 805 to pass and move to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative. Now, Representative Zerwas, House File 236. Representative Zerwas, you want to go ahead and move your bill to the register?
Mr. Chair, members, I will move that House File 236
be re-referred to the general register.
Okay, Representative Zerwas, go ahead with your testimony.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Before we get started, I have met with the medical director from the Department of Corrections, and she's asked for a oral amendment, if it would be all right, in order to relieve some consternation. The Senate added an oral amendment in committee that they're not too excited about. On 2.26, the oral amendment would be... On 2.26, the oral amendment would be a period after corrections, and then striking the rest of 2.26 and the rest of 2.27. And if there's any questions or concerns about that, that would... Am I on the wrong line? Oh, I apologize. It'd be 2.32 and 2.33. I was looking at the unengrossed version. So it'd be after corrections on 2.32, and then the rest of 2.32 and 2.33.
For our staff, not that. You folks understand the amendment, members?
We have staff.
What's that?
Staff.
Yeah, you bet. Either one of the staff, one of the people. Yes.
Mr. Chair and members, on line 2.32, delete everything after corrections. And then on line 2.33, delete everything before the period.
Okay. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas. Just a quick question. Is that in place because... when you're incarcerated, actually health care is a right, and if we allow this, there could be some huge implications relative to cost.
Representative Zerwas?
No, Mr. Chair, members. The concern is from the Department of Corrections. They have a real concern about doing any type of experimental studies or work on an incarcerated population. And we have the medical director from the Department of Corrections if we need a further explanation.
You okay then?
Mr. Chair, that's great. That's what I needed, and just appreciate your comment.
Okay. You understand the oral amendment? As read, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, Representative Zerwas, continue.
All right. Thank you, members. Apologize for that quick oral amendment. House File 236, the right to try bill, is really, for me, it's pretty special. But it's the idea that if when you have no hope and you have no chance, and you've been told and diagnosed by your physician and by your care team that there's nothing else that can be done, what House File 236 would allow is allow you to have one last try or one last shot, and that is in consultation with your doctor, with your care team. If there is a new drug or treatment or medical device that has passed the first phase of the FDA's clinical trials, that is the phase that says, yes, all of our initial trials say this will not cause additional harm or injury, then that you will have an opportunity to try.
Representative, can we hold on a second? Say for the children that are here, the persons with them, we'd like to do introductions if possible. If what's the organization?
I work on
the
Firelight Christian Academy.
Okay, well, thank you for coming.
Yeah,
appreciate it. Okay, Representative Zora, sorry.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And so the bill is providing one last opportunity. Getting government out of the way for you to work in consultation with your physician to give it one last shot and one last attempt at treatment and at life. You see there's a liability waiver in there. Your physician and health care systems would assume no liability under this. There's not a mandate of coverage. And the through health reform, it was shown that with this language structure and the limitations on it, there wouldn't be an additional cost incurred to the public. And with that, members, I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Question, members, Representative O'Neill.
I just wanted to thank you because I'm one of those parents that had a child in this situation. My one-year-old daughter was diagnosed with a glioblastoma multiforme, and I think I must have searched, I don't know, this was in the incept, you know, like very, very early in the, when the internet was up and running, but this happened in 1999, and I think I talked to maybe 10 researchers and got the same answer every time, and this may have, I don't know if it would have saved her, but at least it would have given me some solace that I really did do everything I could do, so I just want to personally thank you. Not as a legislator, but as a parent.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill.
Any other questions?
Representative Considine.
I'm sorry, did I understand you correctly that it would exempt them, though, from medical coverage to pay for it?
Representative Verwas.
Mr. Chair, members, what the bill does is it does not mandate a private insurance company to pay for it, absolutely. So, a lot of times what's being done in the realm of some drugs around Alzheimer's and some other areas is sometimes the drug manufacturer, the drug company, is working out with your physician, with your care team, an opportunity to get the drug to you at a sometimes reduced cost. But it would not be something that would mandate a company to pay for it. It's difficult enough in some instances to get your private insurance company to pay for the treatment you need in the right place you need it. If you want to lecture on that, we can go out for dinner sometime, and I'll tell you about how I almost moved to Rochester when I waited for my heart transplant. But what this would do is it would not mandate, government would not mandate private business to do something, but government would also not impede your ability to try something else.
Representative Sean, or unless you had a follow up, go ahead.
I did. I guess I am finding that a little bit troubling because I think it's a great bill and for reasons that Representative O'Neill, but that kind of sounds like you'd have to be wealthy enough to afford it, otherwise you wouldn't be allowed to do it, and that kind of bothers me.
Representative Sean.
Just to reply to that, Representative Cotton, I agree, and if I could find a way to put in law that would mandate that, it's not FDA approved, and so your insurance company, in fact, couldn't pay for it. And so that being said, I think there are other options in other states where this has been done. This was passed on a ballot initiative in Arizona, and I think it's law in four or five other states. It's in the process, I think, in about a dozen other states. And their families are finding a way to get that care, either in cooperation with the pharmaceutical companies, in community support, in physician support. People are finding a way.
I appreciate that, and thank you. It's a great bill. I just hope it's open to everybody in Minnesota.
I can see the problem, though, if you didn't have that in there, we'd have a lot of insurance companies probably down here today testifying, be a lot of opposition rather than being clear. Representative Schoen, did you have something?
I just wanted to add to a piece of this. So Representative Zerwas and I sit on health care committees together. And one of the things that happens, Representative Considine, in these situations, we had this in the medical cannabis discussion, around the country for families that can't afford it, there's been a lot of organizations that have popped up to raise money and funds to help families that are in need and can't afford some of these things where they It's just an organization that provides grants to the families, and sometimes these pharmaceutical companies are actually happy to have someone in that situation, however sick and demented that may sound to say, but they want to prove that their medicine works. Yep. And this is part of that goal. So I am fully supportive of this because if we didn't have those provisions in, as Chair Cornish said, this wouldn't have made it this far. So it's always a step, isn't it? And, yeah, we want to make sure that everybody gets the care they need, and this is one more step in that direction.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Zerwas, I want to thank you for bringing this forward.
What I see of this bill, and a little bit to represent Considine's issues, is this is actually going to speed up the FDA approval phase. A lot of times these pharmaceutical companies in their testing, they have trouble finding patients that would be willing to be and going through the process. This will allow them to have people come to them to help with the FDA process, getting the information they need at a lower cost. In the long run, it could lower the cost of some of these medications.
Okay, members, any questions, any public testimony? Any closing comments?
Yeah, just briefly, Mr. Chair and members, I was 15 when I was told you're never going to get a heart transplant. There's nothing we can do. Go home. You have a few months left to live. And so I was a 15-year-old kid watching Price is Right and Oprah with my mom, and I had the big fight I had. I picked out all my pallbearers, who was going to carry my casket and who was going to sing and what songs would be at my funeral. And the big fight I had was, am I going to have my best friend, Ryan Ebert, give my eulogy, or am I going to have my godfather, my uncle, Bob Yoakum, give my eulogy? And that was the biggest thing on my mind. And my original cardiologist, Dr. Stone, said, you know, there's a new surgery, and it's never been done in the U.S. before, but we can actually go in and the right side of your heart is enlarged and it's failing. We can cut that out, and they can replace that with the pericardium, with the sac that goes around a cow's heart. And I said, that's never going to work. And he said, well, it might. It might. And he said, and even if it doesn't, we're going to learn so much by doing that if you just try. And at 15 years old, knowing I was going to die, I knew that if I tried this, at least they were going to learn something from it. And it wasn't going to be for nothing. And so, members, that's what I'm asking for here is let's give the rest of Minnesota the right to take that try. And with that, I'll renew my motion.
Well, thank you, Representative Zerwas, and I, for one, am glad you're still above ground.
I'll take it.
Thank you very much for your testimony. You, questions, members, anybody? All right, what's that?
I already asked.
The chair will renew his motion for House File 654 to pass and move to the general.
236.
As amended?
What? 236.
House File, what did I have? Well, I got your next one.
Well,
House File 236.
I'll take that one, too. Can we do a double?
We recommend to pass and move to the general register as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Would you like me to do 654 next?
Yes, go ahead.
All right, I'll move that House File 654, pass and be. Is this going to the general register, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
All right, so I'll have this pass and be referred to the general register. There are two amendments in your packet, Mr. Chair and members. The E3 amendment is the amendment we're going to go forward with today. And so I'll make that motion, Mr. Chair.
Okay, you got the A3 amendment? Do you move the A3 amendment to get it in the shape you'd like? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Representative Zerwas, go ahead with your bill.
All right, Mr. Chair, members, briefly, this bill deals with the Secretary of State's Safe at Home program and some changes to accessing that very secretive, confidential information that the Secretary of State maintains and protects for victims of domestic violence as they go through. This deals with as people in that program go through the court proceedings. I have a testifier from the Secretary of State's office, and at this point I'll let her walk through the bill and kind of what occurred last year and why this is coming forward.
Hey, ma'am, if you state your name and title and begin, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strother with the Office of the Minnesota Secretary of State.
Very quickly, for background for folks, the Safe at Home program is a program administered by the Office of the Secretary of State. It was instituted in 2006 or adopted by the legislature under then Secretary Kiffmeyer, and it's to protect victims of stalking, domestic violence, sexual assault, and others who fear for their safety by providing them with a substitute address that they can use as their legal address in all circumstances. It provides them a P.O. box. So first class mail is then sent to our office. We repackage it and send it out to their actual address. They're allowed to use that P.O. box on, for all purposes. For example, their driver's license shows that P.O. box. When they register their vehicle, it shows their P.O. box. So then in all public data, their P.O. box is what shows up as their actual address. Our office at all times has their real address where they're a legal agent for service of process. It's not a witness protection program. It's an address confidentiality program. You can always contact them by phone. You can always legally serve them through our office. And so there are very limited circumstances when an actual address would ever be needed for the program participant. And current law contemplates three circumstances where that would occur. One is consent by the program participant. If you need your roof repaired, you need to give your real address out. The other is to law enforcement in the case of an emergency. And the third is by court order. And what we've seen in the past couple of years is there's been, since there's no guidance in current state law about when a court can order an address, we've seen some real inconsistencies in the courts as to when they're ordering the address, in part because they rarely encounter a safe-at-home participant in court. There's only about 1,900 individuals in the program representing about 700 households, and so they're, you know, it's a very small population of folks. Raised this issue to sort of a tipping point for us was last year a court ordered a participant without any consideration really to ordered our office to give her address to the assailant. That got appealed to the Court of Appeals. The court reversed, but it was clear then that there needed to be some additional guidance to the court on factors that they should consider when ordering a safe-at-home participant or our office who holds the data to disclose the address. So what this legislation does is provide a framework that the court must consider before ordering disclosure and essentially asking if this information is actually needed, if there's another way to go about getting the information, and then considering the safety of the program participant. The amendment that was added on today was part of a discussion with the Public Defender's Office to ensure that we're not infringing on the constitutional right to confront a witness. And so it makes very clear that if the confrontation clause would be violated by withholding the address, that then it has to be disclosed. But we feel like this will provide guidance to the courts and provide some uniformity across the state when, you know, courts deal with this maybe once in their tenure issue that comes before them. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Members, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see the public defenders are here. Can I ask them a question based on the language they requested?
Okay. Mr. Kyer, go ahead and state your name and organization and begin.
Mr. Chairman and members, Kevin Kyer with the Board of Public Defense. I'll do my best, Madam Chair. This isn't language that I necessarily worked out with these folks. Our Chief State Public Defender, Bill Ward, did, but I'll give it a shot.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, so when you are saying unless it violates the Confrontation Clause, what brought us here was actually a motion by the Public Defender's Office to get the address because they wanted to go out and talk to the victim's neighbors. Do you believe that that violates the Confrontation Clause if you don't disclose the address, you can go talk to the neighbors?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, I think with the language that was worked out with Mr. Ward is that in that case it would have without the language that's in the bill. That makes sense.
So
our issue was, Mr. Chairman and Representative, our issue was we could never meet the threshold that's in the bill. How would you ever meet the threshold of somebody's defense being more important than the safety of that victim, for example? I mean, we just couldn't meet that threshold. And so this is a way, and frankly, our folks have dealt with this, as you know, we deal with these issues all the time. The court seals some of the information or it's not disclosed to the client. You know, we do that all the time. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure that you're just not undoing the very thing that brought us here today. And so one of the things that is very easy to do if you as public defenders want to interview the victim in the case is to produce the victim, not necessarily give you the address of where the victim is. The question is, I want to know where the line is for this new language, because I want to make sure you're not just undoing the very purpose for the bill.
Mr. Chairman, sure. Representative Hillstrom, is we wouldn't. I mean, I understand the concern, but again, we've dealt with these issues in the past, and on a specific case, it's my understanding the Court of Appeals did reverse that district court decision to release that. And, you know, we're very sensitive to it, and I think in the discussions that we've had or that Mr. Ward's had with the Secretary of State's office, we have no intention of trying to undo this. But there is an issue here of trying to, you know, again, balance that so that we, you know, because, again, we would never be able to meet that obligation of balancing somebody's representation versus that their individual's public safety. We couldn't, and nor would we want to.
Mr. Chair, one last question.
I think one representative wanted to, Zerowas wanted to reply, too, to that.
Yeah, and just to be clear, the confusion or the concern that occurred with the prior case, as I understand it, that was appealed, is the victim had relocated and to a new address away from where the incident occurred. And so the defense was petitioning the release not of where the incident occurred to interview people nearby that may have been there for the crime, but they wanted to interview her new neighbors, where she moved to after the incident, and interview and find out her new address. I think if you look at the A3 amendment, it would be hard to show where a new address away from any witnesses would meet that burden and be released.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's actually my point. They've added the section saying unless it violates the Confrontation Clause. And so my question is, we're opening that window, right? And I don't want to violate someone's constitutional rights. I just want to make sure that it doesn't include me getting to say where you live now just because I want to go interview your neighbors on a fishing expedition, right? I mean, that's It's one thing if you need to know based on the ability to defend the case. It's something else if you want to go on a fishing expedition, and that's what brought us here.
Okay. Representative Johnson and then Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, thanks for bringing this forward. I do have a question for Ms. Struthers. I actually at one time served a paper to a person that was involved in this program who has since moved from that address. And it was a subpoena to appear in court, not from the prosecutor's office. It was from the defense of that case. And it was very difficult for law enforcement to deal with it. So I think it's another issue that needs to be dealt with on these subpoenas, because we had to give the mileage for payment, for billing for the service in the paper. But what that did is we give the exact mileage for the payment to present the bill, but it narrows down where that person lives. So I think besides this issue that needs to be taken care of, that might be another issue that needs to be looked at, how to deal with that to make sure that these people stay safe.
Did you want to reply shortly?
I would just say that I'd be happy to continue that conversation outside of committee about how to address that issue. Thank you.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom kind of got to where I was going. Do we have information about why this particular public defender thought they needed to go interview new neighbors? I don't understand. I mean, were they, these new neighbors, somehow going to be exculpatory to the individual and part of the original crime? I mean, I want to make sure that, again, we're protecting their rights and what was the alleged statement other than, I'll maybe should watch my language.
Ma'am?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will say that I don't know if it was actually a public defender representing the defendant in this case, so I just want to make that clear since the public defender's office is here.
Or.
In that case, as Representative Zerwa says, it was actually not just the second address, it was the third address. The person had moved to a new address. The individual they're fearful of found them. They moved to a third address, so it's actually two times removed from where the incident occurred. And I think the allegation was that it's possible they had talked to neighbors about the incident and they wanted to interview the neighbors, but there was no request to interview the neighbors at the second address or the first. Separate from the facts, what was most concerning to us was that the court, in ordering disclosure, didn't consider whether or not the information was needed, didn't consider whether or not there was an alternative way to get the information. Could you ask the neighbors to show up in court? I mean, is there an alternative way to get the information without disclosing the participant's address? The court didn't consider any of that, nor the safety to the participant, and just ordered disclosure. And so this bill would provide some structure around what a court needs to consider before they make that big step in ordering disclosure. So it doesn't prevent disclosure where it's needed, and our intent was always that it wouldn't infringe on the constitutional right to confront a witness, which is why we put in this language here, but it would ensure that we are signaling to the courts that this is a high standard, that there are real safety needs for these participants.
And Mr. Chair, I think if you look at the A3 amendment, the court must consider whether the potential harm to the safety of the participant is outweighed by the interest in disclosure. And I think it could very easily be argued that a second or third removed address or home, clearly what this was an attempt to was to locate the victim in this case and not in the interest in finding that person. It doesn't have an interest in the defense. So I think the Secretary of State's office is comfortable with this language. I'm comfortable with this language. And I think it'll provide the guidance to the courts in the future. Because now it stands now in statute that in determining whether or not to compel disclosure, this is what needs to be considered, where clearly the prior judge just didn't do that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess this is a strong signal why we don't meet like once a decade, why we come together every year, because somewhere along the line, somebody makes a boneheaded decision without taking someone's safety into regard, and we got to come together and do this, and they want more funding, too, this year.
Well, and Mr. Chair...
I'm talking about the courts.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm glad we don't come together just once a decade either. I would miss my buddy Dan.
All right. Any other questions, members? Any public testimony? Any closing comments, Representative Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom, Representative Schoen. I'm a former law enforcement guy. I'd love to just say no. But the Constitution, we want to make sure we're following what we need to follow. And if someone needs a vigorous defense, they need a vigorous defense. They need full defense. We have to keep in mind the safety of the program participants. So with that, I'd like to thank the Secretary of State and his cooperation and his staff throughout this process.
Do you want to renew your motion, Representative Zerwas?
I sure do.
Okay, Representative Zerwas renews his motion. House File 654, pass and move to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
What?
As amended. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Representative Howell, House File 1570, if you want to come up and move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 1570 to be passed and re-referred to the General Register.
Okay, Representative Howell has moved his bill, and go ahead, Representative Howell, with your introduction.
Thank you, members, and this is basically a very technical bill for firefighter licensing and regulation. And I'd actually, Mr. Chair, like to move the A1 amendment to get it close to the shape that the author would like.
Okay. Representative Powell moves the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now, if we could, move the A2 amendment, and then it would be in the shape the author would prefer.
Okay. Representative Howell moves the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye. 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 Opposed? Okay, Representative Howell, to your bill. As amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, like I said, is a very technical bill. It deals with the licensing and regulations of firefighters in the state of Minnesota. The other thing it does is, as well as talking about how you obtain a firefighter license and the requirements thereof, it also provides reciprocity, and I don't think I... it's probably not as easy for me to say as some other folks, but it provides that same similar thing we did for military police to get that and qualify for post qualifications, that type of things. What this does is provide that for firefighters. And so the firefighter training that they get in the military would also qualify for that firefighter training that they bring to the state. So with that, Mr. Chair, if there are any technical questions on the bill, or if my testifier would like to testify to the technical aspects of the bill, we're here for questions.
Okay. Questions? Cool. And did you want to testify, Mr. Rice?
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, Brian Rice, representing the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. This is a technical cleanup to firefighter licensing. That was a bill that was passed 5 years ago. The bill has not received any legislative change since then. The Board of Fire Training is recommending these changes, and Representative Howe is correct. Section 13 on page 4, line 16 is new. When we brought the bill to Representative, also Colonel Howe, he suggested this idea about having reciprocal examination for military members who've had firefighting experience. So we modeled this after a similar provision in the Post Board. And that's not, it didn't come out of the Fire Licensing Board, but they're supporting it, and we think it's a good idea. And so we encourage members to support the bill as amended.
Okay, members, any questions? Representative Newberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for Representative Howe. Is this qualify them for firefighter 1, 2? What level is this? Are they able to go and test that?
Mr. Rice or Representative?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newberg. To be licensed, they'll have to pass both firefighter 1 and 2 in terms of the exam, and then they're eligible to get a license.
Any other questions? Any public testimony? Any closing comments, Representative Howell?
No, I appreciate you hearing the bill, and I believe that this the technical changes, I think, are needed, and I sure appreciate the support for providing that reciprocity for the military firefighters.
Okay, Representative Howell renews
the motion as amended.
That's as hard to say as reciprocity. renews his motion to pass House File 1570 to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Howell. And now I've got my bill, House File 291. If Representative Johnson want to fill in for me here.
Representative Corbis, would you like to move your bill?
I'd like to move House File, Mr. Chair and members, House File 291 to be recommended to pass and move to the General Register, and I have an amendment.
Go ahead with your amendment.
The Chair would like to move the A1 amendment to get it into the shape the author would like.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Okay, before I introduce my or have my testifier take over, House File 291 basically amends the DWI implied consent law to authorize the petitioner to raise an affirmative defense of necessity based on a threat to the physical safety in its response to a Minnesota Supreme Court case, Axelberg case, holding that the common law affirmative defense of necessity is not available in a DWI implied consent hearing. And members, just remember, this doesn't affect the criminal part of the statute. This is the implied consent proceeding of the DWI, not the criminal charge. And with that, if I could have my testifier talk about the bill, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Liz Richards with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. This bill has already been heard in this committee. And it does create, what it does is it creates the possibility to raise a necessity defense in the civil implied consent driver's license revocation proceedings. Just want to clarify why this language change is happening. One is that it will now mirror the Senate version of this bill as well. And by removing the qualifying phrase at the, after the defense of necessity, it makes it consistent with the case law that exists on the necessity defense. And would make it consistent with that. And with that, I don't know if members have any questions. Can certainly address it further, but I know this was heard and discussed in committee already.
Do not see anyone. Anybody have any questions? Is there any public testimony? I've seen none. You wish to renew your bill?
Mr. Chair and members, I would like to renew my motion for House File 291 to pass as amended to the General Register.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I think we're...
We've got everything for today. Meeting's adjourned.